Last week, as we concluded chapter 17, I mentioned and we discussed a bit the false denominational notion that we somehow make Jesus king when we obey him, or we somehow make Jesus Lord when we obey him. And as we discussed, that's not what happens at all. We obey him because he is king, and we obey him because he is Lord. Sadly, many denominational treatments of the book of Revelation belittle the church and belittle Christ, perhaps unintentionally, but it does. To them, the church is just a mistake. It's just an afterthought. They tell us that Jesus failed to set up his kingdom in the first century as he had intended, and that he is not ruling now. Here's what one dictionary of theology says about this notion, premillennialism. It says, it is held that the Old Testament prophets predicted the reestablishment of David's kingdom, and that Christ himself intended to bring this about. It is alleged, however, that because the Jews refused his person and work, he postponed the establishment of his kingdom. Meanwhile, the Lord gathered together the church as a kind of interim measure. That's how premillennialism describes the church and describes the work of Christ. How anyone could read the Bible and believe that Jesus failed in anything he intended to do is just inconceivable to me. How anyone could read the Bible and conclude that the church of Christ is a mistake or an afterthought or an interim measure is just inconceivable to me. Premillennialism is not just a matter of opinion where we can all just agree to disagree. It is a false doctrine that runs counter to the very heart of the gospel, the very heart of the work of Christ in establishing his kingdom. We've said a lot about it in our introductory lessons. We'll say a little more about it when we get to chapter 20. But we're seeing that running throughout this book, and particularly here as we move toward the end. And we see the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, and we see his eternal kingdom, which is the church. Chapter 18 is a form of prophetic literature called a doom song. It's very common in the Old Testament. Isaiah chapter 13 has a doom song for Babylon. Isaiah 34 has a doom song for Edom. Zephaniah chapter 2 has a doom song for Nineveh. In each case, the ruin of a great city is described in vivid, poetic language, interspersed with apocalyptic speech. And here, we have a doom song for Rome. And I think any careful student of the Old Testament would have expected that, because that's what had happened in the Old Testament judgments. And here we see it in this New Testament judgment of Rome, a doom song for the doomed city. Verse 1. After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was made bright with his splendor. Verse 1 reconfirms that this message of doom, this message of judgment, there it's from God. That's where it's coming from the throne. This verse reminds us of Ezekiel 43, where we read that the earth shone with the glory of God. One commentator writes that this angel had so recently come from the presence of God that in passing he brings a broad belt of light across the dark earth. He had just come from the presence of God. That's where this message of doom, this doom song is coming from. Verse 2, and he called out with a mighty voice, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. It has become a dwelling place of demons, a haunt of every foul spirit, a haunt of every foul and hateful bird." In chapter 14, verse 8, the angel proclaimed, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great." In verse 2, here in chapter 18, that message is repeated. It's repeated, and once again, the past tense is used to denote the certainty of this event. If you look back in Isaiah chapter 21, verse 9, over 100 years before the actual fall of ancient Babylon, over 100 years before that happened, the prophet Isaiah wrote, "Babylon is fallen, fallen, and all the graven images of her gods he had broken unto the ground." That was 100 years before that happened, and yet it was so certain that Isaiah wrote about it in the past tense. And we see that here too. Babylon is fallen. Verse 2 goes even further and tells us that the city has become a dwelling place of demons, foul spirits, every foul and hateful bird. I guess that would be a foul fowl. The descriptions of this city is very different from the holy city that we're going to see in chapter 21. In verse 27 of chapter 21, we're going to find in that holy city, there shall in no wise enter into it anything that defileth, nothing that worketh abomination. And yet this city is full of that, full of foul and hateful, doleful creatures. Isaiah chapter 13 described the destruction of historical Babylon in very similar terms. Verses 17 through 22 of Isaiah 13. Their houses shall be full of doleful creatures, and owls shall dwell there. Satyrs shall dance there. The wild beast of the island shall cry in their desolate houses. That's describing the fall of ancient Babylon. Very similar language is used here to describe the fall of Rome. Well, was that a literal description of Babylon's fall in Isaiah 13? We know it was not. We studied that last week. We know that Babylon fell without a shot, but it did fall. That was symbolic, figurative, apocalyptic speech describing that judgment by God. Is the language in verse 2 of chapter 18 a literal description of Rome's fall? No. It's the same kind of language describing the same kind of event, just a different city, just a different enemy of God's people. Well, why is the city described this way? It's symbolic. It's symbolic of the depth of their fall. They have fallen from the heights from a human perspective down to the depth. That's where their fall has taken them. I like what Barclay says about this language. Surely, he writes, the most dramatic part of the picture is the demons haunting the ruins. The pagan gods banished from their reign haunt the ruins of the temples where once their power had been supreme. That's the symbolic image we are to see here of Rome's fall. The language denotes utter devastation. It denotes utter desolation. That is what was meant in Isaiah 13 describing ancient Babylon. That's what's meant here describing this modern, in John's day, Babylon, Rome. Verse 3. For all nations have drunk the wine of her impure passion, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her. The merchants of the earth have grown rich with the wealth of her wantonness. Rome was a great military and commercial power, and Rome enticed other nations to follow her wicked example. Rome was powerful. Rome was arrogant. Rome openly boasted of her abominations. We're reminded again of a description from Isaiah, chapter 10 this time, verses 12 through 14. There, what's described is the arrogant, boastful king of Assyria. And in that king's mouth, we hear the following words put into his mouth in Isaiah chapter 10. By the strength of my hand I have done it, and by my wisdom, for I have understanding, I have removed the boundaries of people and have plundered their treasures. Like a bull, I have brought down those who sat on thrones. My hand has found like a nest the wealth of people, and as men gather eggs, they have been forsaken, so I have gathered all the earth. That's the false, boastful king of Assyria being described in Isaiah chapter 10. And those very words could have been put into the mouth of any of those Roman emperors that we looked at. I have done it. By my power I have done these things. That was Rome's attitude. And Rome was about to find out something very different. They were about to find out the same thing that Assyrian king found out. That it is not they who are running this show. The reference in verse 3 to the merchants of the earth is important, and we're going to see a lot about those merchants in this chapter 18. We haven't really seen them that much yet in the book, but now they're making their appearance, the merchants of the earth. As we like to say, if you want to understand something, you follow the money. And if you followed the money in the first century, you would end up in Rome. It was money that kept the emperors in power, because it was money that allowed them to keep the army happy. And no emperor stayed in control very long if the army was not happy. That's the first thing you learn as you study the history of Rome. They kept the army happy, and they did that with money. Money fueled the fires of Roman power and of Roman persecution of the church. Money, money, money. greed was behind much of this. 1 Timothy 16 was true then, it's still true today. The love of money is the root of all evil. And we see now the merchants taking the stage in this judgment, in this doom song. While Christians were denying themselves, these Romans were denying themselves nothing as they wallowed in their excess and in their money and in their power. And the merchants were behind much of that. Verse 4. Then I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people, lest you take part in her sins, lest you share in her plagues. For her sins are heaped high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities." In verse 4 here, God calls for his people to come out of the city, lest they follow Rome's evil example and share in Rome's destruction. This is a common call in the Bible, made many times in the Old Testament. It was the call that Lot heard in Genesis 19. It was the call that Moses heard in Numbers 16. It was the call that the exiles in Babylon heard many times. Isaiah 48:20, "Go forth from Babylon." Jeremiah 50 verse 8, "Move from the midst of Babylon." Jeremiah 51 verse 6, "Flee from the midst of Babylon." Well, was this call here in verse 4 a call for the people to literally leave the city of Rome? No. And once again, we should look back to that ancient example of Babylon where the same language was used and see what happened there. Were the exiles in ancient Babylon literally instructed to flee that city? Did they literally run from that city of Babylon? No. And in fact, God told them in Jeremiah 29 verse 7 to seek peace and prosperity of the city where I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. The Jewish exiles in Babylon did eventually leave that city. We know they did. They left in three major ways. They left under the decree of Cyrus. They left under we read about in the book of Ezra. They left, as we read about in the book of Nehemiah. But they were not fleeing. They were not running. And in fact, those returns happen after the judgment that's being spoken of here in Jeremiah 50 and 51. That happened under the Persians. That happened under Cyrus and the other Persian leaders. That is not what's being discussed when Isaiah and Jeremiah tell them to flee. It's the same thing that's being discussed here. He's telling them how to live. He's not telling them pick up and run from Rome. He's telling them how to live in Rome. He's telling them the same thing that Paul told us, told the entire church in Colossians 3, verses 1 and 2. "If ye then be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ sitteth on the right hand of God. Set your affections on things above, not on things down on the earth." That's the message here. It's not to literally flee the city. He doesn't want them to be polluted by what's in the city. They are to keep their garments white, keep their garments pure, which is what he told them back in chapters 2 and 3. Barclay, I think, explains it well. He said, and I believe there's a longer quote on your handout from Barclay. Let me just read the last sentence. "It is not a question of retiring from the world. It is a question of living differently within the world." And that's the message of 2 Corinthians 6. "Be come out from among them and be ye separate." Come out from the world. Be separate from the world. But we're not to flee from the cities and go out and live in some sort of commune. We must live in the world to fulfill the Great Commission, but we must not be like the world. And one of my favorite quotes is also on your handout from an excellent book, The High Cost of Holy Living. And the author there writes, "Wherever the Christian finds himself, and whatever his calling in life, his life must stand as a radical protest against the world and its standards." That's the message here. That is the message of this command to come out. And it's a command for us also. Is the church today becoming more like the world, or is the world becoming more like the church? Is the world setting our agenda, or is God setting our agenda? Perhaps as Woodworth once said, the world is too much with us. Maybe we also need to look again at those verses telling us to come out and be separate from the sins that are in this world. Verse 5 tells us that Rome's sins were heaped high as heaven. Yes, God is long-suffering. But at some point, sin reaches a level that is intolerably high, and judgment falls. In Ezra 9 verse 6, Ezra said of the people in his day, I am ashamed and blush to lift up my face to thee, my God, for our iniquities are increased over our head and our trespass is grown up unto the heavens. How high are our own sins in this country? How close is our own country to that divine tipping point? How many remain in our own land who are ashamed and blush to lift their faces up to God? I'm reminded again of Jeremiah, a wonderful book, chapter 8, verse 12. Were they ashamed when they had committed abomination? No, they were not at all ashamed, neither could they blush. He writes, I don't know how close we are to that tipping point, but I'll tell you from a study of the Old Testament and the New, when people are no longer have the ability to blush and even feel ashamed at the sin they are committing, you're very, very close. Verse 6. Render to her as she herself has rendered, and repay her double for her deeds. Mix a double draught for her in the cup she mixed. As she glorified herself and played the wanton, so give her a like measure of torment and mourning, since in her heart she says, a queen I sit, I am no widow, mourning I shall never see. So shall her plagues come in a single day, pestilence and mourning and famine. She shall be burned with fire, for mighty is the Lord God who judges her. God commands that Rome be punished and that vengeance be exacted. To whom is this command directed? We know it's not directed to the church. Why? Because the church is commanded not to seek vengeance. Romans 12:19, for example. Well, some argue that this command is directed to the 10 horns, who in chapter 17, verse 16, we learn hate the whore, hate Rome, and in fact would eat her flesh and burn her with fire. Very likely it could be directed to them. Other argue, no, it's directed toward the angel. The angel who's acting on God's behalf as his instrument of judgment. Another possibility. But one thing is absolutely certain here. Vengeance does not belong to man. It belongs to God. This is vengeance. It is a divine vengeance from God, from the throne of God. Deuteronomy 32:35, vengeance is mine, God said. Romans 12:19, do not avenge yourselves. Vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord. That verse contains a command and a promise. The verse that commands us not to avenge ourselves is the same verse that promises us there will be vengeance. We see the same thing in the Old Testament about ancient Babylon. Jeremiah 50:29. Repay her according to her work. Do to her what she did to you. But that is a divine vengeance, a divine retribution. The double punishment in verse 6. It may come from the old law, where there was often a double repayment for as a penalty for law-breaking, Exodus 22. A more likely explanation, though, in my view, is that it refers to a balancing of the scales. And it's not a balancing in the sense that the scales become even. It's a balancing in the sense that first the church was here and Rome was here, and then it's like this. Rome takes the place of the church on those scales, so it's a double movement. So Rome moves into the place where the church was on those scales as Rome had placed the church there. And I think that's confirmed in the next verse. As she glorified herself and played the one, so give her a like measure of torment. As she did, you do to her. Another important lesson we learn here is about pride. If you want to see pride, look at Rome. All human pride will one day be humiliated. Pride goes before destruction, a haughty spirit before a fall, Proverbs 16:18. And Rome's supreme sin was its pride. Had no need of God. Ezekiel 28:2-7 could have been penned about any of those Roman emperors. In those verses you read about the king of Tyre. Because thine heart is lifted up and thou hast said, I am a God, I sit in the seat of God. That's what those Roman emperors thought. They thought they were God. They thought they were sitting in the seat of God. Horrible, arrogant pride. Thought they had no need of God. No need to heed the word of God or listen to God. In verse 7, Rome boasts that she will never see the very thing that God said she would see. She says, a queen I sit, I am no widow. Mourning I shall never see. This whole book has been telling Rome, you will see mourning. Rome is saying here, I'll never see that. Rome's pride, like all pride, caused Rome to feel it had no need for God. Rome was all Rome needed. Rome was full of pride, thought it would never fall, it could never fall. And Rome was not the last nation to feel that way. Rome would plummet from her glory to her destruction quickly, and her destruction would be total and complete. Rome's affluence, Rome's pride, Rome's gaiety would be replaced by death, by mourning, by famine. Again, we're reminded of a similar pronouncement against ancient Babylon in Isaiah 47, verses 7 through 11. There, writing of ancient Babylon, we see very similar language. The prophet writes, "You said, 'I shall be a mistress forever.' Now therefore hear this, you lover of pleasures, who sit securely, who say in your heart, 'I am, and there is no one beside me. I shall not sit as a widow or know the loss of children.' These two things shall come to you in a moment," the prophet writes. Very similar language to what we see here written about Rome. Both Babylon and Rome were filled with pride, and both later had to eat their boastful words. Isaiah 14, very interesting chapter. I wish we had more time to look at that chapter. That chapter presents a very vivid picture of that Babylonian king going into the underworld after his destruction and meeting and being greeted by the kings of all those other fallen nations who persecuted the people of God. And I'm imagining that Rome, those emperors of Rome, Nero, Caligula, Domitian, they also made that trip. And they also were greeted by the king of Assyria, the king of Tyre, king of Babylon, those other kings who had persecuted the people of God. Isaiah 14 paints a very interesting picture. Egypt, Babylon, Rome. You know, people ask, well, is this book relevant today? It's relevant if for no other reason than to show us that history is repeating itself over and over. You know, some people say, well, history doesn't repeat itself, it's just historians repeating each other. But yes, history does repeat itself. We're seeing it here with Egypt, with Babylon, with Rome, over and over again. And Rome was not the last nation to rise up against the people of God. Rome was not the last nation to face the judgment of God. Rome is just the nation that's being described here, just as Babylon and Assyria and Tyre and Edom and those others were described in the Old Testament. That's a lesson we can get from this wonderful book of Revelation. Verse 9, "And the kings of the earth who committed fornication and were wanton with her will weep and wail over her when they see the smoke of her burning. They will stand far off in fear of her torment and say, 'Alas, alas, thou great city, thou mighty city, Babylon, in 1 hour has thy judgment come.'" Verses 9 through 19 contain three dirges for Rome. The first is here in verses 9 and 10, sung by the kings. The second is in verse 11 through 16, sung by the merchants. We meet them again. And in verses 17 through 19, we see a dirge sung by the shipmasters and the sailors. Each of these dirges speaks of the greatness, the wealth, the luxury of Rome. Are those descriptions, the ones we're about to see, are they historically accurate? Is that the way Rome was? The Talmud says of the 10 measures of wealth that came down into the world, Rome received 9 of them. And the rest of the world, only 1. Wealth was concentrated in Rome. And it was concentrated and controlled by the Roman emperors that we've been studying about. Listen to what Suetonius has to say about the emperor Nero. "He never wore the same garment twice. He fished with a golden net drawn by cords woven of purple and scarlet threads. It is said he never made a journey with less than 1,000 carriages and with his mules shod with silver." Suetonius says that Caligula would drink pearls of great price dissolved in vinegar and set before his guests loaves and meats of gold. Barclay says that nothing John could say of Rome could be an exaggeration. Another writes that our most extravagant luxury is poverty compared with the prodigal magnificence of Rome. In the time when John was writing, a kind of insanity, one author writes, of wanton extravagance, to which it is very difficult to find any parallel in history, had invaded Rome. Rome had it all. And Rome thought the church had nothing. But of course, as usual, Rome had it exactly wrong. Exactly the opposite. Rome was the one that had nothing. The church had everything. The church was the one that was rich. Rome is fallen. That's the message of this book. The kings in these two verses, the military might, the power of Rome, we've seen it already throughout our study of this book. I'm sure these kings were thinking, how can we lose betting on Rome? How can we possibly lose betting on this horse? And yet they'd bet on the wrong horse. Verse 11. And the merchants of the earth weep and mourn for her, since no one buys their cargo anymore. Cargo of gold, silver, jewels, pearls, fine linen, purple, silk, and scarlet, all kinds of scented wood, all articles of ivory, all articles of costly wood, bronze, iron, marble, cinnamon, spice, incense, myrrh, frankincense, wine, oil, fine flour, wheat, cattle, sheep, horses, chariots, slaves, that is, human souls. The fruit for which thy soul longed has gone from thee. All thy dainties and thy splendor are lost to thee, never to be found again. The merchants of these wares who gained wealth from her will stand far off in fear of her torment, weeping and mourning aloud. Alas, alas, for the great city that was clothed in fine linen, in purple and scarlet, bedecked with gold, with jewels, and with pearls. In 1 hour, all this waste has been laid, all this wealth has been laid waste. This lament and the other laments in this chapter are very similar, and they're probably modeled after the laments against the city of Tyre, also a very wealthy city, also a judged city. And that lament is found in Ezekiel chapters 26 through 28. If you have time later this week, you might look at those and compare those to chapter 18. These verses describe the great commercial success of Rome. And verses 12 through 14 in particular describe the vast extent of that commercial trade and success. Aristides left us a good description of that. It's on the handout. I won't read all of that to you, but the last sentence is telling. He writes, if there is anything you cannot see at Rome, then it is a thing which does not exist and which never existed. If you wanted to find it, you could find it at Rome, he writes. The phrase slaves, that is human souls, in verse 13, interesting. A better translation might be slaves, even the lives of men. There were some 60 million slaves in the Roman Empire. It was not unusual for a man to own 400 slaves, and those slaves were used for many different purposes. Some masters had slaves just to walk in front of them and greet their friends for them as they walked down the street. Others had slaves whose only purpose was to stand behind them at dinner and give them witty quotations to say during the dinner party. Others reminded them when to eat and when to sleep. They had a slave for every purpose. And yet here we see it just as part of the merchandise. It's part of the sin that's heaped up. It's part of the things that are being bought and sold. And John, through inspiration, adds, that is human souls. They were trafficking in people. They were trafficking in people. As Barclay reminds us, a society built on luxury, on wantonness, on pride, on callousness to human life is necessarily doomed. That was true then, it's true today. Why do the merchants weep? They weep because of their lost business. That's why they weep. Their lament is not for Rome. Their lament is for their lost profit. They have merchandise and no one to sell it to. Their concern for Rome, I see it much like China's concern for us today. Is China concerned for the welfare of the United States? You bet they are. They've got a lot of money invested here. They are concerned. Is it because of their love? No, not at all. Totally motivated by their self-interest. That's what we see here with these merchants. The merchants, like the king, stand far off and watch the destruction. They do not attempt to help the great city. The kings believed that Rome was a stronghold and destined to endure forever. The merchants believed that Rome was a market destined to endure forever. If there is one message in the book of Revelation, it is this. There is but one eternal kingdom. One. And it's not Rome. It is the church of Christ. That is the eternal kingdom. The church of Christ is the only eternal kingdom. No other kingdom will endure. Many commentators discuss at length the various items listed there in verses 12 and 13, and we're not going to go through each one of them. But in short, those are all items that could be found in Rome. And they arrive from all parts of the world. The cinnamon, the silk, likely came from China. The spices likely came from India, from all over the world, arriving in the city of Rome. And yet verses 16 and 17 are chilling. Chilling. Alas, alas, for the great city that was clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet, bedecked with gold, jewels, and with pearls. In 1 hour, all this wealth has been laid waste. Much could be said of that statement and its relevance, both then and now. But I'll just quote Homer Haley in his commentary. Here's what he said on those verses. What about the United States, which has been a land of plenty and great abundance? It is taken much for granted, wasting and squandering its resources. Is it approaching a time when it shall reach for the great abundance bestowed upon it by God and find it gone forever? Rome reached that point. Let's continue on in verse 17 where we left off. And all shipmasters and seafaring men, sailors, and all whose trade is on the sea stood far off and cried out as they saw the smoke of her burning. What city was like the great city? And they threw dust on their heads as they wept and mourned, crying aloud, Alas, alas, for the great city where all who had ships at sea grew rich by her wealth. In 1 hour she has been laid waste. Nero's fire raged a week and failed to destroy the entire city. And yet this fire that God sends destroys the city in 1 hour. Rome's fall is total, complete, and worse than anything Rome could imagine. We see in these verses the incredible materialism of Rome, this time from the viewpoint of the shipmasters, those who brought in this cargo, also making money off of this merchandise. And if we're looking for modern day parallels, this focus on materialism is one that's impossible for us to miss. We may still print "In God We Trust" on our money, but our actions speak much more loudly than those words. You know, the motto, "In God We Trust," you know, it appeared on our coinage during the Civil War. But there's one particular gold coin that does not include that motto. Why? Because President Teddy Roosevelt specifically asked that it be excluded from that coin and not put on that coin. Why? Because he knew the lifestyles of the men out in the West who were using that gold coin in brothels, in gambling halls, in saloons, and he did not want that phrase on that coin when they knew it was being used for those purposes. He wrote a letter in 1907. He said, "My own feeling in the matter is due to my very firm conviction that to put such a motto on coins or to use it in any kindred manner not only does no good but does positive harm and is in effect irreverence which comes dangerously close to sacrilege. A beautiful and solemn sentence such as the one in question should be treated and uttered only with fine reverence, which necessarily implies a certain exaltation of spirit. Any use which tends to cheapen it, and above all, any use which tends to secure it being treated in a spirit of levity, is from every standpoint profoundly to be regretted." 1907, about 100 years ago. My, how times have changed. My, how times have changed. How far have we already fallen? Sadly, most people today trust in their dollars rather than trusting in God. They have everything that money can buy. They have nothing that money can't buy. As one commentator noted, like the uprooted vine that generated the self-consuming fire in Ezekiel 19, a culture that worships commercial success will strike the sparks that ultimately burn it to ashes. We see it with Rome. Are we seeing it again? Verse 20. "Rejoice over her, O heaven, O saints and apostles and prophets, for God has given judgment for you against her." Rejoice, the verse says. The saints, the apostles, the prophets, they're shown in contrast to the kings, the merchants, the sailors. Rome's judgment is a cause for rejoicing. God's people requested justice and God has delivered it. The righteous are victorious. Evil has been defeated. Rome was the one rejoicing back in chapter 11 when Rome thought it had defeated the two witnesses and killed them. And that rejoicing was premature. Now the tables have been turned. Again, a parallel with ancient Babylon, Jeremiah 51, verse 48. They shall sing for joy over Babylon. But I thought we were supposed to weep with those who weep. Rejoice with those who... This rejoicing is because of the divine retribution that has occurred here. This is not rejoicing out of personal bitterness. This is rejoicing because their prayers have been answered. This is the same attitude of the four living creatures who look constantly at the holiness and the reputation of God. That's what's at stake here. They rejoice at the vindication of God. They rejoice at the great defeat of this enemy of God. These events are an answer to their prayers. How could they not rejoice at this? God has imposed on Rome the sentence that Rome passed on the church, and they rejoice for it. They're commanded to rejoice for it. And in later chapters, we will see that rejoicing with beautiful symbols. Verse 21. Then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, "So shall Babylon the great city be thrown down with violence and shall be found no more. The sound of harpers and minstrels, of flute players and trumpeters shall be heard in thee no more. And a craftsman of any craft shall be found in thee no more. And the sound of the millstone shall be heard in thee no more. And the light of a lamp shall shine in thee no more. And the voice of the bridegroom and bride shall be heard in thee no more. For thy merchants were the great men of the earth, and all nations were deceived by thy sorcery. And in her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all who have been slain on earth." A great millstone is thrown into the sea by a mighty angel to explain how the great city would be thrown down, found no more. Again, a similar image about ancient Babylon. Jeremiah 51, verses 63 through 64. "Bind a stone to it, cast it into the Euphrates. It shall be found no more. It shall rise no more." Rome, like Babylon, would fall never to rise again. There would be no revived Roman Empire. It's interesting, but not surprising, that premillennialists teach just the opposite. They think an antichrist will somehow one day rule over a revived Roman Empire. This is telling us there will be no revived Roman Empire. It will never rise again. Verses 22 through 23 show us five aspects of normal Roman life that would just vanish. The sound of musical instruments and rejoicing, it would go away. The sound of craftsmen plying their trade, it would go away. The sound of the mill would disappear. No lights in the houses, it would go away. Darkness. The sound of weddings would no longer be heard. Rome is about to suffer a terrible, dark, and silent desolation. Rome, which had once set Christians aflame in Nero's garden to provide light for the emperor's orgies, would be plunged into darkness and silence. Again, similar descriptions in the Old Testament. About Judah in Jeremiah 25, verse 10. About Tyre in Ezekiel 26, verse 13. Well, why did this happen? Verses 23 through 24 give us three reasons why it happened. 1. Thy merchants were the great men of the earth. 2. All nations were deceived by thy sorcery. 3. In her was found the blood of the prophets and of the saints and of all who have been slain on the earth. Was Rome a great nation? Yes. It was the greatest the world had ever seen from an earthly perspective. But Rome had not used that greatness for a good purpose. Instead, Rome had used its greatness to deceive and mislead the world. Rome had made its material greatness the very goal of its existence. Rome had used its great power to persecute and murder the people of God. Rome had caused all nations to adopt her false standards, adopt her false worship. Rome fell because Rome was covered with the blood of God's people. And like the city of Tyre in Ezekiel 24:6, Rome had become a bloody city. Rome fell because Rome worshipped wealth and luxury. Rome fell because Rome lived a prodigal and wanton life. Rome fell because Rome found no pleasure except in materialism and perversity. Rome fell because Rome was lifted up with pride and felt it had no need for God. Waste, materialism, wantonness, perversity, pride, the shedding of innocent blood. Do we see any modern day parallels in that list? Chapter 19. God told his people to rejoice in chapter 18. And that is what we're going to see him doing here in chapter 19. They rejoiced over the fall of that great city. They rejoiced over the victory of the church. The great joy of those who overcame and conquered is compared here to the joy that accompanies a great wedding feast. The picture is one of victory and unrestrained joy. The battle of Armageddon that we first saw in chapter 16 is also, again, considered in this chapter. The two beasts are defeated, cast into a lake of fire. This chapter provides some of the details that were omitted when that battle was first described. Verse 1. After this I heard what seemed to be the loud voice of a great multitude in heaven, crying, "Hallelujah! Salvation and glory and power belong to our God, for his judgments are true and just. He has judged the great harlot who corrupted the earth with her fornication. He has avenged on her the blood of his servants." Verse 2 provides an important focus for what's about to be described. Verse 2 tells us that the focus of this joy and the focus of this judgment is the great harlot. It's the same great harlot we've been looking at. It's Rome. That's the focus of this chapter, Rome. We should keep that in mind if we're ever tempted to leap ahead thousands of years in our study of these final chapters and say, well, now we finally reach the end of all time. We haven't yet in chapter 19. He's telling us right here, this has to do with the great harlot. This is the same great harlot who's sitting upon the seven hills. This is the same great harlot that's drunk with the blood of saints. This is Rome. This is first century Rome. That's what chapter 19 is still talking about. So let's keep that in mind as we continue on through our study of chapter 19 and the following chapters. A great multitude in heaven here rejoices over the judgment of this harlot. This great multitude, who we first saw in chapter 7, God's people, living and dead, they're pictured there in heaven. God is always picturing the church in heaven in this book. Even those who were still alive in Rome, suffering persecution, God has pictured them in this book as already safe and secure in heaven. Those that dwell upon the earth, that's the wicked in this book. They're still on the earth. They're still set upon the earth. And that's how it's still pictured here. These are the people of God, the great multitude, the church. Verse 2 reminds us that God's judgments are true and just. God's greatness rests not just on his power, but on his character. His judgments are always true and just. And this judgment of Rome is no exception. In judging Rome, God avenged the blood of his martyrs as they had prayed for him to do in chapter 6, verse 10, where they cried with a loud voice, "How long before you avenge our blood upon those who dwell upon the earth?" That prayer set these events into motion. And verse 2 tells us that prayer has been answered. That's why they're rejoicing. Their prayer has been answered. God is judging and has judged Rome as they prayed for him to do. Verse 3. Once more they cried, "Hallelujah! The smoke from her goes up forever and ever." Rome is depicted in verse 3 as a city set on fire by God that burns forever. In chapter 18, verses 9 and 10, the kings of the earth stood far off and watched the city burn. The shipmasters also watched the city burn. Fire is a common symbol for the judgment of God. Sodom and Gomorrah were literally destroyed by fire. Yet that fire eventually went out. And yet Jude 7 tells us that fire still burns. Jude 7 says it is an eternal fire for Sodom and Gomorrah. What did Jude mean by that? It is an eternal example. That fire still burns today as we read and study about Sodom and Gomorrah. We're seeing that smoke today as we recall that example. The same is true for Rome. Rome provides an eternal illustration of the power of God and of his ability to deal with anyone or anything that opposes his will and harms his people. In that sense, Rome burns forever and the smoke of Rome is always visible. We're looking at it here today. Next week we'll pick up with verse 4. Thank you very much for your attention.